General Practice has a new enforced contract come upon them. And in this episode, we're going to talk about what that document has actually outlined, what it possibly means for you, your practice, and your patients. And towards the end, we're going to talk about some of the actions you may want to consider in taking in preparation and planning for this new contract in General Practice that we kind of had no choice over. We're going to tech enhance your primary care and learning in this unique episode. Let's get cracking, shall we? Hello, EGP learners, and welcome to this really unique episode. As you can see, me and Andy are not in our normal place. We're in a different part of the country, and we're about to analyse the new enforced changes on the GP contract for 23-24. How are we doing there, Andy?
Yeah, pretty good. So it might be worth just explaining where we are. So we're up in Harrogate. We're here for AirCon, which is a board game conference. We'd had this planned for a long time, didn't realise that the new contract was going to drop, but we thought we'd bring along our podcasting equipment and do a session from up here in our Airbnb.
And shout out to a couple of guys who've been really accommodating. We've had a bit of an adventure already before in terms of getting set up for this, so shout out to them. But we are going to get cracking right now talking about this new contract and that's been enforced upon General Practice. That's the phrasing that many people are using and stuff. And just to be clear, what we're going to do for this session, because we appreciate it's quite dense in some parts, is that we're going to outline some of the changes. We're going to talk about the annex, which has a lot of the details in the particular document. And then after that, we're going to talk about some of the actions you may want to consider in your practice that have either been recommended by other places and even our own thoughts on those particular actions and stuff and what this actually means for General Practice.
We have made a note to remind you and ourselves that we are not your commissioners, so it's important to liaise with your local commissioners and your ICB and your LMC about how you actually implement the contents of these contract changes. So we're going to be spending some time looking at the general structure of this document is there's a letter that introduces the main concepts. I think that's where we'll be spending most of our time talking through things, and then we'll highlight the annex, which contain a lot of detail about the implementation. Please do spend some time there, but it may not be that entertaining for us to go through that line by line.
It also has a couple of key points that aren't mentioned in the forward that I think a lot of people have actually driven past and stuff, so not taking notes of those and stuff. And I guess the other thing to mention is absolutely you can join us in this discussion. So jump into the chat. Let us know what you're thinking. Let us know what your thoughts are, whether you think this is good, this is bad. We absolutely want to hear from you, and we will bring that into the discussion as we go along and stuff. And if you are joining us, give us a thumbs up to let us know you're out there as well. I really appreciate it. Shall we have a look at the document though, Andy?
Yes, so we've got a screen share, and we've made some notes of talking points to the document. So we'll start with the main body of the document.
There we go.
Sorry. And here it is on screen. So this is the main body of that. So it starts with, and we're used to this from the documents these days, it starts with, we recognise and appreciate the incredibly hard work of General Practice during this period of sustained significant pressures. So it's got the usual platitudes there at the beginning. I think when we hear that, that often means actually what's coming later will not be so pleasant to read. So it's got that, those usual thanks there. But I mean, we're very used to that at this stage. It's talking about, this is the evolution of the five-year framework of the PCNDES and the agreed core contract. Acknowledging that actually a lot of details are still to come as well. So we have this delivery plan for recovering access to primary care, which will be published shortly. So I think we've been waiting for that for a while.
So we've actually been waiting for that since January. So we're now obviously in March when we're recording this episode. So that document's massively overdue. And it does reference a couple of times that this is where a lot of the potential additional resource is going to come from it within that document. I think one thing also to mention, just because we passed it, the paragraph two that talks about obviously the changes and stuff references a couple of other documents, in particular the Fuller Stock Take, which is a significant document. We reviewed that back in May, I think it was, when it came out. But it doesn't mention the Health Select Committee report, the one written by the Chancellor, at all.
You know, actually, we thought that in the car on the way up, but I'm just looking at it and I can see the words "and the Health and Care Select Committee on the Future of Primary Care report." So I guess they've had sight of it while writing, although it doesn't really talk to many of the concepts in there, particularly around valuing continuity and some of the other points that were made in that document. So it's almost as if they haven't seen it when they wrote it.
Maybe.
But they do reference it there. I just noticed that. So yeah, and I think the delivery, the GP access plan or delivery plan for recovering access in primary care, I think they reference that as a source of support, whatever that means, and that might not be financial. And also a lot of the detail, I think, in terms of what some of these points around access will mean will be within that document.
Mm-hmm.
So they're talking about changes to the GP contract. Candy, I had a question. So I was asking in the car on the way up because this document talks about changes to requirements for access for general practice.
Yep.
And it also talks about some release funding. And the funding which is talked about in this document is from the IIF mainly to support that activity. But it talks about a requirement on general practice. And I was trying to get my head around whether they are actually varying the core contract requirements for what we deliver, or whether what they are talking about is varying the PCN DES requirements, and that you will need to meet these new access requirements in order to receive the IIF funding, but would not be in breach of your core contract if you didn't do them, or are you going to be in breach of your core contract if you do fail to meet the new access requirements? Did you get your head around that, Candy?
So I can't give you a clear-cut answer because, similar to yourself, I couldn't actually get my head around some of it. What it does mention is that this is a change to the main contract. The wording I can't quite remember, but it does mention changes to the GP contract regulations. And then it also makes changes to the IIF, which obviously sits within the PCN DES and the ARS roles in particular. So those changes are made directly to the PCN DES, which is absolutely within NHS England's gift. You can argue absolutely that it should still be agreed with the GPC. Important to recognise, and we've mentioned this earlier, this is an enforced contract which the GPC have not agreed to. So this has not been agreed by our union and by our negotiators that this should happen. We don't actually know what that means, though, because this is actually the second time that's happened now. Mm. And actually, general practice has continued, and we've obviously still been doing work and stuff as previous. I don't think it's as significant as the next contract. So many of us know that the next contract agreement is the five-year one, which is basically because technically it's the end of the PCN DES next March. And obviously what that will look like, absolutely no idea. But this doesn't set a great tone for that, does it?
Yeah, I just wasn't sure whether they were able to vary the core contract without the involvement of the GPC, but it may be that they can.
I think it's more of a case of they said this is what we're doing and we're not going to accept the differences or change that you want to make, and as a result of that, that's why there's this impasse. Obviously the GPC have set out plans for their webinars and stuff to inform the general practice basically what this potentially means and moving forward what actions they may want to consider, and may want to sign up to those in your local area, because I know they're doing some amazing touring and actually some pretty good videos as well. I'll give them a hats off to the BMA. Their videos about this kind of stuff are actually quite interesting. But I think, you know, it'll be interesting to know from them directly. And if they do want to join us, they are welcome to do so. Absolutely. Hmm. Shall we get cracking with the document?
Yeah. So I think the main and most controversial statement and paragraph within this document is this first paragraph of the access requirements thing. And it may be worth just hanging on some of the words there as we go through. So a requirement will be to offer an assessment. The offer of an assessment will be equitable for all modes of access to ensure consistency in the access that patients can expect. The GP contract will be updated to make clear that patients should be offered an assessment of need or signposted to an appropriate service at the first contact with the practice. Practices will therefore no longer be able to request that patients contact the practice at a later time. I think that's the most controversial.
Yes. So this is the big thing that's obviously caused a lot of concern, frustration, confusion, shall we say?
I
actually think the first sentence is actually quite sensible. And I know there may be some people out there thinking, oh my gosh, Gandhi, what the flub are you talking about and stuff. But if you read what the first sentence, and the first sentence alone, offer an assessment will be equitable for all modes of access. So this, in my view, means that if you are offering appointments to your patients and stuff, that whether they make those requests through online, telephone, face-to-face, smoke signals, basically you have to treat them as equitable to the access needs that they have. And I think that is a sensible way. Many of you know I'm a massive tech geek and love my digital stuff and things, but actually there are absolutely patient groups where the mode of consultation doesn't work. And there are some practices we know of that will do everything face-to-face. Does that digitally exclude those people who want to use the digital ones? Maybe. There are practices where they have gone digital only. Not digital first, but digital only. And actually, does that exclude those patients who would then have face-to-face? And I think the sentence to me sounds sensible. It's unfortunately followed by a couple of other sentences that raise a bit more concern, but I'm going to hang my hat on that. I don't have a problem with the wording of that particular sentence as a contract agreement as such. Do you want to know how to use System 1 more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, and that's the System 1 course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPPS1course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System 1 more effectively, from getting started with System 1 to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPPS1course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly. Even better yet, there's a money back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then.
Yeah, I think I agree. Maybe you're right, and this is a shot at maybe some practices who might be out there that people have considered have been a bit restrictive in terms of sending patients down one route or another in terms of how they contact the practice. So, and yeah, I mean, I guess that's reasonable. But some of the later parts are controversial. I think it's largely that there's concerns that this will not be workable within the resource envelope and the workforce constraints that we currently have. It will not be workable to.
We will talk about the resources, because there has been a lot of commentary saying that there's no additional resources being put into this, which is true. At this moment in time, there's no additional resources. They have signposted the change in resources to support some of this work. Absolutely, you can argue, is it enough? Okay, we'll come to that. But I think the key part that many people have frustrations and challenges with is the point that it says that patients should not be told to contact the practice back. And that raises a question of what on earth does that actually mean in terms of manageable outcome and stuff?
It's difficult. I mean, we've been on a bit of a journey in practice this week. A lot of people we were quite demoralized actually earlier in the week with this, because we thought a big way that practice managed demand, and when I want a GP appointment, what happens is I contact the practice. If they don't have appointments, they tell me to ring back at another time. You know, and I think that happens up and down the country, and it is very frustrating for practices. But practices, I think, have difficulty understanding what else they can do when they have ran out of capacity on the day. And they will argue that actually this is an example of a sort of a passive measure that makes sure that that appointments end up with those patients who really need them, or at least have the ability to persistent if they continue to perceive that they have a need for an appointment. Some people give up, and some people give up because they no longer need the appointment. So that passive barrier option is gone, and I think people are wondering what they will do if they need to hold this patient query and deal with it in that single phone call. How can you possibly do that when you don't have appointments to book?
Well, it's interesting. We've talked about the fact that in previous streams that, you know, effectively when you provide service for free, there still needs to be a block somewhere to make it manageable. Because otherwise, if you have unending access, then, you know, how do you meet that from a capacity point of view? And like you say, the fact that for some patients having to call back in itself is a block is actually a method of managing those patients who have genuine need versus those who have health anxiety driven need, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But obviously, we know that currently that is massively outstripping the capacity and therefore having an impact on obviously retention of staff, working conditions and various other things, meaning that actually that's why we're struggling and stuff.
Yeah, just look at it another way. I mean, I guess when there is a resource which is finite. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that you can manage access to that, if you are not going to put a monetary cost on it, mm-hmm. is to introduce some sort of passive friction into the process of accessing that. Means that those people that don't value it mm-hmm. as much, because they perhaps don't perceive that their need is that great, will not access that service. I think that's what we're driving at. But anyway, I've been on a journey. At first I was really devastated. Actually, is the model of the way I run my practice no longer sustainable? Mm. That's where I was at the beginning of the week. I still might be there actually, Gandhi. But what I've learned with these documents is that sometimes they want their headline. I think NHS England, the government department,
got a headline,
and the next day there were lots of headlines, Daily Mail and all of the usual suspects. GPs will no longer be able to tell you to call back the next morning. And I think to a certain degree, maybe that's what the government wanted. They wanted to have their headline, and then actually, I wonder if when details emerge about the implementation of this, actually, once those headlines have settled, maybe actually we will find that there is less difference or less upset in the detail. We may not. I don't know. But I think that's been the experience of some of these announcements in the past.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned that obviously it talks about that there is some funding to support this. Mm-hmm. Obviously not additional at this moment in time, but it talks about realigning the IAF funds to support this work. And we will go into more details to what that means, because it is important that you know the detail, because it is quite interesting and stuff. But I think, one of the comments it makes is about this whole assessment of need. So I guess, and I know we're not talking about the outcomes at this point, the actions and stuff, sorry. But one thing is potentially to change every type of contact with patients to an assessment of need, because then you're satisfying it. The interesting part that we talked about in the car coming up was the fact that how on earth are they actually going to monitor this? How are they going to evaluate this part of the contract part? Because actually, from a tech perspective or from a data perspective, there's no hard intelligence that tells you. There may be some soft stuff. Yeah. I know you were talking about.
Yeah, maybe they can do some secret shopper type things.
Yeah,
I know. I think our CCG have done this in the long distant past. And there's kind of soft intelligence, I think, of the sort that CQC sometimes use to monitor practices in terms of complaints.
Patient survey. Yeah. Those may be some of the markers they might use.
I think also they're providing some QI quaff targets based on monitoring this ourselves as well, in terms of coming up with a plan and providing some data around it, I think. So some of this might be self-monitored.
So we're going to move on to the other parts in a second. Just before we do that, we've already got loads of comments coming through. So thank you, everybody, for jumping in and joining us. We've actually got loads of people joining us this Friday evening, which is really nice.
I think it's fine to have a chat about this. This is the main bit, isn't it?
So I asked the question, what do you think about patients not being told to call back, basically? I can't remember. I don't know if I've rephrased that correctly. So a couple of comments. So we are cross-platform. So Nat comments that total triage, same-day cap and capacity. Anish Patel is talking about that this is about referring to wider primary care team if we are full, CPCS, walk-ins, etc. So that's about signposting to other services. That assessment of need, you can now be seen in the CPCS. You can now go to a walk-in center. There are other options. Absolutely agree with that, Anish. Various other ones. So Jaish is jumping in and talking about the waiting list. We're going to talk about that shortly. Yeah. And we already do this in the practice with total triage by Anish again. We set safe limits. We tell patients they have goals where their acute needs and have routine slots for others and stuff. Nuda talking about the fact we need alternative solutions. Again, we may come to that in some of the sections and stuff. Mark jumping in, what we've got here, very challenging to assess practices for patients and professional colleagues, not sure the contract solution, but GPC not offering an alternative. Is there one? Well, interestingly, so the GPC said, and if feel free to go watch their videos, I would recommend looking at it. So BMA TV is the YouTube channel. And on that, they outlined that there were three requests they made to the government. One, and apologies, I'm probably going to butcher this. It was one was about tackling workload. One was about supporting the existing staff to retain staff. And I've forgotten what the third. I think the third one was reducing bureaucracy. Those are the three requests the BMA made in part of the negotiations. And then from their perspective, none of those were met. And that's why they haven't agreed this contract. So that's why it's not agreed. They're now looking at the outcomes from that moving forward and stuff. There's loads more comments coming in. I'm going to have a quick read of these as Andy tells us about the next big change that came through. And this is one that I think will give some people nightmares and some people think, All right, whatever.
Okay, so just to highlight, we'll be talking more about those access issues towards the end and thinking about solutions and, you know, for the problems.
Make sure you stick around for those because we've got some really interesting stuff for you.
Keeping you on the hook for those things. Perspective. So future looking record access to be offered by the 31st of October. I mean, if they stick to that deadline, I guess, because that keeps being pushed.
Four times it's been removed. Yeah.
That keeps being pushed back. I mean, I think that's fairly self-explanatory, Gandhi. We've talked about that in depth before and some of the problems that poses. And this may not be the time to go into all of those, but I think practices know about those issues.
And we knew that this was going to come at some point. One of the key things it talks about is the fact that it is going to happen from their perspective from the 31st of October. So you've got just over 6 months to get your practice teams ready this time. And I can't see them shifting it again. I mean, that's serious egg on their face if they had to do it. They are pointing out that there are 6.5 million patients, 1,400 practices, I want to say, that have currently already gone online because they chose not to opt out. And obviously this will be a mass switch on unless patients have already identified that they do not want their records, open access and stuff. There is some interesting stuff that we will talk about that comes in the annex on this section that you do want to see.
Good. So you've highlighted that big, Andy.
Yeah,
that's good.
It's somewhere in there. We'll get to it in a second.
The next point is that they will mandate the use of cloud-based telephony solutions. So we were trying to work out, you know, how they're going to do that, really. But they basically say that from 2025, all analog ISDN and PSTN lines will be removed for use in all home and business settings. So we had visions of people coming in and ripping out telephone infrastructure from premises that people might own. But I think we weren't quite clear actually about whether there was some sort of rebate or funding for telephony that comes through our funding stream at some point, and whether, because they talk about later, other solutions will no longer be supported. So we wondered if some funding might be removed. I don't know if you've got your head around that.
No, it was slightly unclear on this particular section. I think the key thing here is that they seem to know something we don't. You know, ISDNs and stuff are apparently going to go in 2025 completely. Does that mean we're moving to 5G all around? I mean, that's going to have some of the conspiracy nuts really going for it and stuff and things. But I think, you know, it sounds like that the infrastructure behind telephony is due to change. And apologies, we don't know about this. But we don't know, so I'm assuming many of you don't know. But it's going to cloud-based. The key thing with this is that what they are suggesting is that they're not going to let practices just do what they want with this. And this is really important. So they're going to create something called the Better Purchasing Framework. So this is similar, I guess, to the GPIT Futures stuff that is around clinical EPR systems. But this is going to be purely around telephony. They are going to create a list of approved companies that can provide telephony services. And you will only be able to purchase from those if you want some of the whatever they're giving, which we don't know.
Yeah. So you only be able to purchase from that framework, and I guess provided there's a good number of providers on there to provide some price competition, then that might not be too much of an issue. And I guess they have information governance issues and requirements that they might want to put on those providers or ensure that they are compliant. So good.
And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, I've spoken to several of these companies that provide these cloud-based solutions. They are really good, let's be honest. They can really potentially help you in your practice. You know, the concept of call waiting, some of the adaptive stuff that you can put into there and stuff, you know, a friend of the kind of stream, Exxon in particular, we've covered them a few times and they've supported some of the work that we've done. So slight declaration there. But I think, you know, the concept of cloud-based telephony, I think, is amazing. The infrastructure to make sure it happens and the costing, absolutely something we need to have looked at and stuff in more detail.
Yeah. And we have it. It's fantastic. You can get really great real-time dashboards of the demand, call, waiting.
Yeah.
So actually they are good products. So I don't think that's any bad thing. And they talk about support. So it'd be great if there is support for that to happen. So the next bit is some of the money, really, which so they talk about how are we supporting these access requirements, and they talk mainly about changes to IAF and a little bit about changes to QoF. Gandhi, do you want to talk us through?
Yeah, so we're just going to do this bit. Should we do it in depth or breadth? What do you think?
Let's give them the headlines.
Okay.
I think.
Headline changes. So there are currently 36 indicators for IAF. They are changing those to 5 indicators only that will be assessed. And for that, there will be a total of £59 million available to networks to use from that. So it works out just about £1 a patient when you factor the fact that the population of England is approximately 57 million people. And those 5 indicators, so there's 2 around the vaccine IMS, early cancer diagnosis, 2-week waits, and learning disability health reviews. Have I got that right?
I think so. Yeah. If we go through systematically, we'll get there anyway. I think we can give some of the detail that's in the letter, but probably not so much from the annexes.
So that's the big change. However, that raises the question: what they're doing with the rest of the money for IAF. So total for the next financial year is 246 million. So therefore, out of that, they are allocating 172 odd million, which will be given to support the access work that NHS England are asking you to do. And that's 70% of total, and that'll be paid to networks on a monthly rolling basis. And I've forgotten the term of the name that they're using, the capacity and access support payment.
So we've done some maths around that, and these are really rough maths, but based on population of England, that works at about £3 per patient. That's 70%, which appears to be being paid with few strings attached to support the access activity to PCNs, not directly to practices, but to PCNs. So it works out at about that much. So for if your practice has 10,000 patients, that's obviously going to be about £30,000. If you have a typical network of 50,000 patients, a typical PCN, that's going to be about £150,000. So that will buy you a few members of staff. And then there's an additional payment, isn't there? So the remaining 30%, which totals about £74 million, will be paid at the discretion of ICBs. I think ICBs will have to work with practice and primary care networks to develop access plans or access recovery plans, and then there's another 30% that can be paid based on the achievement to these access plans. That works out about another £1.30 per patient.
So John, hopefully that answers your question about, can you say more about the IAF funding numbers? So hopefully we've answered that for you. I think, as Andy mentioned, important to remember that for that additional 30% in quarter one, so that's from April to June of 2023, networks will have to do an assessment of their access. And that report will then form the basis of which you will then be assessed on later on towards the end of in 2024. And that will be how the ICBs will allocate the remaining 30%, which is, as you mentioned, about £1.29 per patient, approximately, from our estimated numbers and stuff.
Yeah, and there's also some changes to QoF coming. So again, we were just getting our head around this earlier in the week, but there's a reduction from 74 QoF indicators to 55, and I think that's the removal of many of the disease registers, or the requirement to hold the disease registers.
Yeah.
Which frees up about £97 million, which will be continue to be paid out based on those disease register figures from 2022-23, if I've articulated that correctly. It's in the document. We encourage you to have a look, but we're just trying to talk to these points now. So I guess that's great if you add up to date disease registers that reflect what your population is now and potentially going forwards in 2022-23. But I know a lot of people will have struggled to maintain those throughout COVID, and they might not represent the true disease burden. So,
Well, I think there's another part to consider as well. So actually, some of those disease registers may actually have a higher number of patients, and actually QoF is based on prevalence payments within your populations. So I guess the key one I'd be thinking about is the hypertension one, because actually over the past year, many of our IAF work has been focused around obviously hypertension, atrial fibrillation awareness and that kind of stuff. You know, many networks have been focusing on, you know, recovery plans of managing their chronic disease in the earlier parts of the year, because actually QoF wasn't secured by many local ICBs, may have tailed off a little bit in the past few months and stuff, but actually those changes may have changed the prevalence and actually changed the amount of income practices would have made from their QoF income. It's hard to judge, I'll be honest. That's not an easy thing to work out, but I don't know, it may be a good thing, a bad thing, but actually what they've taken away is the register of the patients themselves. They've not actually changed any of the other indicators. Well, actually, they have. they've added some more.
Yeah, yeah, but and actually maintaining the register was one of the less challenging components of QoF. You know, let's face it. So are we talking about the changes in the annex, Gandhi?
So there are more detailed changes, which we're going to come to. I guess the ones it mentioned, the forward, is the fact they're going to add two more indicators around cholesterol management. I kind of wonder if this is to do with the new drugs.
Yeah.
We saw this with DOACs last year, didn't we? How there was a priority to ship patients to edoxaban. I wonder, we haven't got the detail, speculation, absolutely. But there are obviously some new drugs designed around cholesterol management, whether these will have a factor into some of those. It talks about reconciling one of the indicators from AFO7, which is one of the atrial fibrillation. We'll talk about that one in more detail because it's a bit interesting. There's some other words around that. And then the last part about QoF was the QoF QI changes, which is a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, so so this year's QoF QI modules will focus on workforce wellbeing, which I think is good. It'd be interesting to see exactly what that is, and we don't really know at this stage, but I think that will be welcome to encourage practices to do some work around that, and also optimizing demand and capacity in general practice with an information on using data, see what analyze potentially avoidable appointments, and build on care navigation use. So I think that really lends itself to supporting the access requirements, and I guess if people will be doing some of that work around improving care navigation, and you know, avoiding reducing potentially avoidable appointments, then it's probably good to also be rewarded for that in QoF.
I guess the way I'm looking at this is, so the wellbeing one, great, that sounds like a really sensible thing that actually NHS England should be supporting us with, and actually it's giving you some funding for doing the work on wellbeing, whether that's things like your staff surveys, you know, whether it's other kind of work and stuff. We will wait and see for the detail. The capacity and demand stuff. So I wonder if you could actually twin this with this access report that you have to do for the ICBs. And actually, why can't it just be the same thing? Maybe that's one way of just saving yourself some work.
Maybe that's the intention.
Maybe. We will see. So just before we go on to the next topic, we've got a lot of comments coming through and stuff. I guess worth just flinging over to a couple of them. There's a couple of questions, I guess, about the cloud telephony stuff and things. Mark McCartney, no cloud-based telephony, have a separate number for fax.
Okay,
you shouldn't really still have the fax there, Mark.
He's done a smiley face.
Maybe his
fax is in the skip like everyone else's fax.
Jennifer mentions about what happens to those who have already gone to cloud-based telephony. Simple answer is, I don't know. What it does mention is it's about changing over at the end of your current contract. Now, does that mean that if you've already made the jump to cloud-based telephony that you've missed out? I'm afraid we can't answer that question for you.
It's not quite clear what support there is anyway.
It doesn't mention what support. But the key thing may be if you're with a provider that's not one of the approved ones, it's going to be on the better purchasing framework. That might be a bit of an issue and stuff.
Yeah. Well, then that contract you'll have to move over, I suppose.
Yeah. And then unknown Facebook user, do you know if this means GOs, later clarified to be GPs, working remotely, won't be able to use their own phones for calls? It depends what system you use, is the simple answer on that. I would suspect no, because actually a lot of the cloud-based telephony platforms work directly through the device that you would dial into the system, so your laptop or whatever and stuff and things like that. So I would probably assuming no, although ideally GPs shouldn't really be using their personal phones for making calls, ideally. And I'm pretty sure we're not in an ideal situation always and stuff, but that's the key thing from there. And John asked again, so he said, thank you for our comments about the IAF, and have you got any details about what QoF indicators are going? Yes. Stick around. We're going to go through that, and there's some interesting stuff in there.
And it's in the annex if people want to dive in more detail. Gandhi, I've got a question for you, actually.
Go for it.
It strikes me there's quite a lot. It's a loaded question. So there's there's been quite a lot of flip-flopping over IAF markers over the past few years with COVID. Things have been coming in. Things have been delayed. I know working within a primary care network, we've been getting ready with our clinical pharmacists to deliver a lot of these IAF indicators because a lot of them are pharmacy based. And now they've gone. I guess I'm sort of answering my own question really, but it's a very inconsistent approach from NHS England, isn't it? What do you think's going on there?
Don't know. What I will say is that the reconciliation of the IAF indicators for me is a very welcome thing. So obviously my other hat, PCNCD, the fact that we've now only got effectively six things you need to do for IAF is very, very, very much welcome. interestingly, so if you look at the majority of the IF indicators, a lot of them are prescribing based and very much targeted towards our pharmacy based staff supporting us with that. And actually, almost all of those are now gone. So actually, there is, you could argue that by doing what NHS England have done, they have released the capacity within your PCN pharmacist teams to do other work. Now, could that other work be targeted around meeting some of the demand? Maybe. It depends on how well trained those pharmacists are, as in whether they are trained to do obviously things like minor illness, that kind of stuff in terms of acute demand, or focus more on prescribing elements, so acute prescription requests, that kind of stuff, which obviously forms a lot of the acute doctor demand and stuff that we have. So you could argue not only have they made the work a little bit easier, they have actually freed up some capacity within our PCN teams, depending on obviously how that works in your network and area and stuff. Being a little bit presumptuous that actually these changes are probably a little bit more helpful than I think people possibly realize. I know there's some comments in there about the 30% in terms of the access funds, and that's what they're going to be beating us with a stick with. It's 30%. It's not a huge amount compared to some of the ones that you're actually going to have. So it's not horrific, but absolutely it is not additional funding to the access stuff.
No, it's funding that was already coming the direction of general practice.
It's just changed the way you make it. So it is, you could argue it is easier to achieve for general practice to have that. And is that a gift? Maybe, maybe not. It depends on how I think you look at it. You know, many of us, I think, would much rather prefer that was just put into the GMS and Global Sum. I appreciate, you know, that there are taskmasters at play here that may be also something we have to factor in and stuff and things. But yeah.
Well, that's
does that answer your question?
It does a little bit. I think I'd answered my own question when I was asking it, really. It's just, it feels like the goalposts have shifted, I guess, from what were perceived to be the goalposts a few years ago. Okay. And I guess that's understandable. And it's probably good that they're being agile and repurposing that funding. And it's good that 70% of it, it appears, would come without too many strings attached, which I think is a bonus.
So just as we go into the next session, first of all, thank you everybody for still joining us. We're just over half an hour into this, and you know, we've got loads of people. I am blown away by how many people have actually joined us this evening. So thank you very much. If you are finding this useful, please, just for the algorithm, give us a like, give us a share, whatever and stuff. They really appreciate it and stuff. And we're now going to talk about the next big thing that's come through, which is the ARS changes.
Yeah, so there's going to be some increased flexibility around the ARS roles. And I think the big thing here is that advanced clinical practitioner nurses will be added to the advanced practitioner roles, and that cap will be 3 per PCN, which I think is welcome. And they're certainly a staff role which lends itself to dealing with demand.
Absolutely.
Well, in general practice, particularly.
So you could argue they are reconciling some of the funds from the IAF to give you funds for access stuff. They are increasing the roles that you have that can deal with acute access issues. So in terms of unplanned care and that kind of stuff, like the ACPs and the advanced nurse practitioners. And therefore, you could potentially now look at creating a workforce that could deal with that additional slough demand in your network areas, possibly around hubs, which fits with the fuller stock take direction and stuff. The only problem I have with this is they've announced it when most networks have probably already figured out what they're going to be doing with their spend for the next financial year.
It's coming a little bit late again, isn't it? Everything is always very late and last minute, and a little bit more foresight and planning obviously would be very helpful for everybody. But still, it's welcome.
This absolutely would have been far more sensible if they put it in the October change along with the DTL, the digital transformation leads and the GP assistant stuff, because actually that would have meant that networks had the opportunity to assess and get these people in post and work towards it. Now, I suspect there's an element of you've got a year to do it before there's changes and everything and stuff, so you've got a year. But actually, and I'll give my example, my network has already planned on how we're going to spend our ARS roles funding for 23-24. Yeah. We've got an idea of what our network is going to look like. And this is literally just throwing the cat among the pigeons.
Yeah, it's really annoying. I suppose the next paragraph gives us some further sort of it's positive encouragement to PCNs to continue to recruit the ARS staff, just further reminding us that the ARS staff roles reimbursement will be considered. So staff employed through the scheme. So I think there's an implication that the staff need to be in place as we cruise from 23-24 to 24-25. I think that's implicit. Will be considered part of core general practice costs, and their funding will continue going forwards. And they're just encouraging people to continue to recruit ARS staff and offer people permanent contracts, and guaranteeing they are, not us, that funding will continue.
Key point. The only thing they have confirmed, however, is the ARS funding, PCN clinical director funding, core support funding,
£1.50, £1.76,
transformation funding. Everything else that networks currently have has not been confirmed yet.
And that's maybe another podcast, but yep. I guess that will either disappear or remain within the control of primary care networks as they look like now,
possibly ICBs,
or move into control of another part of the NHS, and maybe either all or just some of that resource for primary care network management may continue.
So we're moving on from the ARS roles, but do stick with us for the annex bit, because there are some extra parts in there which we haven't mentioned and aren't in the forward letter that you may want to know about and stuff. But we are going to talk about the last part of the letter, which is the IMS and VACs part.
Yeah, I'm going to let you talk about this, Gandhi, because you had a better grasp of this when we were
So, off the forward, there is a lot more detail in the annex, and some of that detail is probably too much detail even for us to go into. But the key change that they've made is that they've removed the lower threshold for the IMS and VACs for the catch-up side of things in terms of routine childhood programs. Now, this was a massive bone of contention for many areas of the country, because this significantly negatively impacts areas of deprivation and challenge in that sense. So particularly if you've got high mobility of patients, particularly coming from abroad, they may not be able to have the appropriate catch-up vaccinations because they've already had them in another country, but actually you can't do that. Or that they may have had chosen to have them late for whatever reason, those patients may have done so. And therefore, as a result of that, those populations were significantly negatively impacted by this and losing significant amounts of funding that practices rely on in order to keep running. So they have removed that lower amount, which is absolutely a welcome change. You could argue they should have done this at least at the start, or in better yet, never put that requirement in the first place, because it is going to have an impact on some practices, financially being cash buoyant over the next year or so. They have also changed the thresholds. So they've lowered a lot of the thresholds for the other vaccination parts to make it more attainable. They have also increased the upper threshold. So actually, if you're really, really good at them, it's slightly harder now to get the higher payment. I think that's how they balance the payments. So this therefore means that most practices should get some of the vaccination funding, but maybe not all. And then it talks in the annex, and we'll come to this, about some of the other vaccination schedule changes, which if you are involved in IMS and VACs, you do need to know about some of these things, and we'll come to them in a second. Thanks, everyone, for their support. And there is something about the weight management service continuing and stuff. That's the summary part done, I believe.
I believe so. Just to finish off, I guess, just reminds, no additional requirements added to the PCN core DES specification. Oh, yes. So that means that things that were anticipated to come along, like
we think.
Yeah. Well, no additional requirements will be added. So hopefully. But we believe that that means that anticipatory care, personalised care plan requirements may not be coming. We'll have to wait for the contract details, which are coming in April.
The reason why we say we think is they were planned to be in. So does that wording mean that they're not going to add any new criteria in, or is it that they're not continuing with the anticipatory and personalised care DES? That's the reason why we're saying we're not 100% sure, because the wording is slightly ambiguous in that point. But we'll see. We did, however, say that we go and talk about the annex. And the annex is actually where a lot of the detail is. So Andy's scrolling down.
So we'd highlighted some bits. We'd encourage people to go and look at all of the annex, or particularly those bits that are of particular interest to them. And Gandhi, you just noted some things which we thought it would be worth highlighting.
Just extra bits. So these aren't mentioned in the forward, but potentially useful for you to know. So there's simplification of GP registration requirements. So they're basically talking about a couple of wording changes. It's a really minor thing, but it's something that people need to be aware of. And actually, there are plans to create a better way to register your patients using digital means and directly through NHS England themselves, that actually, once you're on board, some of that would be potentially quite time-saving for your admin teams, particularly for those practices with high mobility and stuff. Again, shout out, I've got some live streams coming up with people who are looking at this actively. So if you want to find out more about that, definitely join me in April. I'll be talking to several companies that are looking at this process and stuff.
I was going to say, again, as we go through, it's just highlighting there are some things in the annex which are just completely not mentioned in the foreword. So it's worth looking. Just things about the GP retention scheme, for example, and removing the four-session cap, for example. So we won't talk about that in detail, but there are things that are just completely not
Yeah, so just for clarity, if you didn't know, so the requirement for GP retainees to do no more than four sessions was actually removed during COVID. They're just saying that they formalize this. They're just going to continue that and stuff and things. Next, it talks about the ARS funding. So just to go into a little bit more detail, so to clarify, so for what was it, advanced practitioners, if your network size is less than 100,000, you can now have three. If you're more than 100,000, you can now have six. What's not mentioned in the forward is they've actually added in some additional new roles. So they've added something called an apprentice physician associate. Now, I think I know why they've done this, Andy.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So there are many universities and stuff now starting to churn out UK trained physicians associates because the courses has just started. And actually, you know, this now means that you could potentially onboard an apprentice physicians associate within your network and therefore train them up for primary care, because actually a lot of the focus of their training isn't around primary care, it's more on secondary care. And therefore have that funded with a view for them developing, partly because that this does seem to be some challenges with getting them on board with their training and stuff. So I can't remember the exact issue with that, but someone mentioned to me that about this a while back, that this would be a really sensible way for them to support things. And it looks like they have done that. And it is a reimbursable role. So that may help. They've removed the cap of mental health practitioners.
Yep.
So
if you can find one.
Yeah. And also suggesting they may be able to now do first contact mental health, which is what the original DES said back in 2019. Really, I'll be really clear. This is one of the things that should have been in place from the start, but okay, fair enough. They didn't. And the last one, which is, I was jumping for joy when they finally included this. So advanced practice pharmacists can now supervise network pharmacists. I mean, why the flub this wasn't in at the start is beyond bonkersness. But sorry, my incredulity is just going off the charts.
But welcome.
Finally. And people can see on the thing, I've written in the comments, finally, in capitals and stuff, because this should have been in place at the start, but it's there at least for year five and stuff.
Good.
There's a bit more.
Yeah, I'm just scrolling down to find what we've highlighted. So you've done these highlighting, Andy, so I'm going to let you lead.
So I think this was this is IIF. So IIF, learning disabilities health checks. We mentioned that's one of the five criteria that's continuing. So they are adjusting it slightly, they're adding ethnicity as a requirement for those health checks and stuff. That's a really minor change, to be honest, and stuff. They're also making some changes to FIT testing, which is continuing as part of the early cancer diagnosis portion. Basically adding personal care adjustment, which basically means an exception reporting part that it shouldn't be done where patients have got active rectal bleeding. And also if you don't have access to the testing, which some areas may not do, although they're looking at putting some additional support to help those areas that may not be able to. The QoF changes. So I think John asked about this. What are the QoF changes? Okay, let me make sure I get this right. So we talked about the registers going. In addition to that, RA002, which is the face-to-face review of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, is going. So it doesn't have to be a face-to-face review, I suspect, is what is going to happen, looking at that. And also the dementia care plan review is going to be going as well and changing to become an all-encompassing mental health review thing.
And the mode of review will be amended and can be determined through a shared decision with the patient. So I guess that may remove a requirement for a physical review if that can be achieved over video or telephone, potentially.
Yeah. Now, some people may gloss over these, but I actually think this is a significant change because these are two cohorts of patients that actually you are having to potentially bring into the practice or go visit for a face-to-face review to say that you've done it properly. I am guessing there are some practices out there that may or may not have done that, up to you. But I'm aware that, you know, obviously it does specify within the QoF that it should be a face-to-face review currently. So the fact that they have changed the mode of consultation, they've not said that you're getting rid of the reviews. They just changed it so it doesn't have to be face-to-face. I think this is a really sensible change they've made and welcome. And again, should have been a change that happened way back when COVID hit.
It helps support capacity to meet some of these demand criteria, doesn't it? And certainly I think with rheumatoid reviews, I mean, often they're still under sort of 12 monthly or more regular review by their hospital teams, and it often feels like you don't add too much seeing them face to face, since they're seeing the hospital teams face to face, you know, within the 12-month period in any case. So I think that's a really good change.
It mentions about a wording change. So this is to do with AF007. It's one of the atrial fibrillation ones. And basically, I think they're just including the other drugs to make it more sensible. So they basically just ported over the IIF requirement and turned it into the QAF one. And the part that I said that you needed to be aware of in the annex, so I put a scrunched face emoji next to this. There will also be a number of other small changes to indicator wordings and values in 2023-24.
so what does that mean?
You know, and that's basically open season to say we can change anything however we want at any point.
As long as it's small.
Well, what is the definition of small? Is that £2 million worth? Is that £20 million worth? Is that £1
worth? Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the QAF stuff. I said we'd cover the immunization stuff. We've covered most of this. I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. So there's the personal care adjustment about patients who have registered too late within a practice, so either too late in the year or have missed part of their vaccination schedules. And that's very much welcome for those populations where there's obviously a lot of mobility of patients. It then also talks about some of the JCVI changes. I'm going to summarize this really briefly. So HPV is moving to a one-dose schedule for majority of patients, apart from those who are immunocompromised. So that should therefore mean less of an issue in terms of vaccinating these patients, because they're using more modern vaccinations and stuff. There's a couple of things about timings, with coordinating it with the school version, the boosters and stuff, and the item. They're changing some of the naming of the vaccinations. So it's now going to be item of service, not SFE or something else and things. The payment is still £10.06 for HPV. And then it talks about shingles, which is a little bit more complicated. Shall we scroll down to that one, Andy?
Yeah, probably there.
Because I need to remind myself. Yeah, that's it.
Yes, the number of doses.
So apparently Zostavax, which is one of the shingles vaccines, is now no longer going to be in production in the near future. So therefore, they're changing that to Shringix, I believe it's called, which is a two-dose vaccination. Yeah. So important to note, the workload for that has doubled. But, and please don't hold me to this because I'm not a vaccinations expert and it's a little bit confusing and it's 9 p.m. on a Friday evening. It is only for immunocompromised patients. However, although that's a small subset of patients, they are increasing the number of patients that can be viable for the shingles vaccinations. So taking it down to patients aged 60 to 80 for immunocompetent and 50 to 80 for immunocompromised. I think I remember that correctly from when I read it.
I think that's what I'm seeing here.
Okay. Yep. So there is an expansion. This is due to happen from September. So for this part, I mentioned earlier, if you are put someone involved in the vaccination and IMS part of your practice or network and stuff, you probably need to start planning for this now. My tip would be coordinate it with your flu vaccines, because actually you're going to have a much bigger cohort of patients potentially, depending on your local population type, to vaccinate with shingles as well as with flu and stuff.
Yeah. Do we know if there'll be a sort of a catch-up program for that? Because when they introduced shingles, they sort of did a rolling program.
It mentions catch-up somewhere. I can't remember the wording of it, though.
So it's not that we're getting everybody aged 60 to 70 in all at once, that it maybe we start at 61 and 65 and work them up or something like that. Yeah. But we don't know the answer to that.
No.
We hope that it would be.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, so there's no other significant changes to the vaccinations according to the document. Yeah. And then lastly, I believe it talks about weight management, which says continuing at £11.50 per referral if you can make it.
Good. Gosh. And there's more in the annex, but people can have a look at that at their leisure. Mm-hmm. Any comments coming through, Gandhi?
So we've had a fair few comments coming through and stuff. So we talked about a few of them. So Nat's coming in terms of there's a general election next year. They want to target the political point when their GP access.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, as I was saying, I think often these documents are for multiple audiences. And one of those is the Daily Mail or other sorts of press and media to get the right headline out there. And I do wonder if actually the detail may take in a slightly different direction to that headline grabbing statement.
And Kasim coming in with a useful comment for us, that something may explain some of the stuff we talked about. So cloud-based telephony, the UK is turning off all POT lines as a standard copper wiring in 2025. You won't be able to get a regular line. You can now use landline. It's all VoIP based, so it's all internet based, which is what we were kind of saying about 5G and all that kind of stuff.
That's helpful. No, thank you.
And he also says thank you for the update, listening to his drive on Out of Hours. Thank you for listening, Gassim. Definitely. But we haven't finished yet, so please don't go anywhere. If you're sticking around, we've just got a little bit
just
more we
back,
want to cover.
Back to access, I guess. Just a reflection, Gandhi, at this stage, having gone through this a few times in preparation and doing it this evening, actually, a lot of what's in here is actually we could consider positive. The big negative is these statements around access, and not being able, you know, making this assessment of need and not being able to ask patients to contact the practice at a future date. And I think if that wasn't in there, we might be viewing this differently. So I think a lot of how we feel about this hinges on the detail around that and how we interpret that and how that's implemented.
And how it plays with that access report that's pending and stuff. Yeah. I think that's the key thing that, there is potentially some additional support coming. We don't know what that is at this point. And obviously we don't also have the absolute detail of what the new contract is going to look like. They will probably publish this, I'm guessing, on the 31st of March. That seems to be NHS England's modus operandi and stuff in terms of doing it. So we will most likely be reviewing that both ourselves and with our colleagues, you know, Ben and Tara from PCM Plus, who we obviously do a lot of supportive work with and things. But I think before we talk about some of the other stuff with access, I think it's important to remember there are potentially some actions practice want to consider. Mm. And other people have come up with some ideas as well. So we're going to review those options you might want to consider. And absolutely, these are your choice to do so and things in terms of looking at what you can do and stuff. So we're going to talk about those actions now. I think we've kind of outlined a couple already. Yeah.
I mean, so we'll bring up some information that had come out from Cambridgeshire LMC in a minute. Is this a nudge in the direction of the division of acute and chronic case streams as discussed in the Fuller report? Is this a further nudge in that direction?
Yeah.
Do you think?
I mean, it looks like it's a way of pushing it forward. I guess this to me says that NHS England are looking very much closer at the Fuller stocktake as the direction of travel for general practice, more so than the Health Select Committee report, which I think is something that we're a little bit unhappy about.
Well, we were really pleased with that report, weren't we? The methodology behind the Fuller stocktake report is less transparent than that behind the Health Select Committee, but the methodology behind the Health Select Committee was very robust, taking statements from up and down the country, statements in Parliament to the Select Committee, written statements, written consultation exercise, and that was all explained within the report. So that was a very, very robust report, and I'm sure the Fuller stocktake is an excellent piece of work, but it's sort of less transparent about where those suggestions had come from and how they were arrived upon. But it feels like it might be a nudge in that direction. Gandhi, do you think that is the right direction for many PCNs to, I mean, some people might say the funding is sort of directed at PCNs to make this access happen. You know, should we be looking at using our PCNs to develop a triage service or an acute stream? Is that
that's the direction of travel that many people have been suggesting, that it needs to be on different footprints, bigger than practices, because practices are saying that they can't cope and they don't have the workforce to do so. So therefore, they want to look at alternative solutions that work over a different footprint. I guess it's important to note that some places, you know, that may work. You know, if you've got a network that's one or two practices of a small geographical area, that clearly is an opportunity to make it work more sensibly. I think if you've got a multi-faceted network with multiple partners, significant geographical areas, that raises the question, can you put one hub in a place that works, or do you have to think about digital hubs as an alternative? And actually, where is the workforce for this coming from still? You know, because actually a lot of the workforce, apart from the newly included AMPs, which should have been included 6 months ago, at the very least, you know, could help with, but actually you need GPs for this stuff. So where are the GPs coming from? What other roles could you use? How could you blend it? How can you make it work? I think there are too much to consider for that to happen and stuff.
I think there's a lot of different solutions, aren't there? And the Fuller stocktake style separation of those streams might work in some areas. Some areas practices will just say, please just funnel, you know, direct the money to us, and I think we can make the best go of making this work. And there'll be all sorts of solutions
absolutely
in between. And I think NHS England, I suspect, probably will what will be most important to them is that they have a solution which works and delivers, rather than the exact model of that.
And I guess reflecting, so me and Andy had a very interesting discussion coming up in the car about this, and the fact that actually, you know, what is more priority? Is it access? Is it continuity? And very much the direction of travel seems to be, again, access over continuity. When time and time again, we know that continuity is the thing that leads to better health outcomes of a population. So are they going down the right path? I think we would probably say it needs a review to look at how that's going to work for various different areas.
Maybe a health select committee review.
Maybe, you know, who would have thought it, you know, and stuff. But yeah. I guess other people have looked at this, though. Maybe worth looking at their comments. Just before we do, I know it's because of a question we've had. Kasim Bhatti asking again. P.S. Is this recorded for viewing later? Absolutely. You can go back and watch this on the YouTube channel. Go back and watch it again and again and again. Really nice if you did. And definitely share it with your colleagues and stuff as a talking point to understand what's happening next. There are some other comments and stuff coming through, but we did want to cover some of the information we've had from elsewhere. Various organizations and people have put commentary about this. So Tara's mentioned about the 14 questions you might want to consider when you're reviewing the document for yourself, which I would highly recommend looking at. So Tara Humphreys from Business Healthcare podcast. I think the NHS Confid have come out with their summary, which basically summarizes the document and also talks about some of the things you may want to consider. For me, the Cambridge LMC document is probably one of the most,
blunt. I'm not sure. I don't know quite what the
pragmatic
word is. Pragmatic. Yeah. Pragmatic. Let's use the word pragmatic because it does provide some solutions and I think or suggestions. And I think some of these might mean that the result on patients' experience of access might not be what the government intended.
So I'm just going to stick that on the screen so you can see it. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to find a version of this document that's the full thing. It's the tweet that we're having to link to a good friend of mine, KBT Bramall-Stainer, who's the, and apologies if I get your title wrong for this, Katie, the clinical director or the MD or whatever of the LMC itself. We will stick the link to that in the comments, in the description and stuff. But effectively, when we're reviewing the actual document itself.
So we look at these 15.
Yeah.
Or the numbered points, I think, are really.
Yeah. So I'm just going to say, I think that's too small for people to have a look at. So let's just take it off. And
we can just talk to it.
So basically, there's various different recommendations that they have made. I think other LMCs are making similar recommendations or already made similar recommendations. I know our LMC have already made similar recommendations in the past. But effectively, the first one was talking about some of the changes you might want to make within your practice. Just to list those out, so it's moving to 15-minute appointments automatically within your practice.
Yeah, so I think this is part of they are saying that the you know, across Europe, the definition of a safe primary care day is no more than 25 appointments, and that includes 15-minute appointments. So they're basically making the case that general practice should move to a crisis footing and focus on safety and operate to those. To those guidelines as part of that, and part of that will be moving to 15-minute appointments. So that's quite a bold move, I think, to make those statements.
I think it's a really sensible one. We should be having 15-minute minimum for GP appointments. You could argue it should be 20 minutes because actually GPs are now seeing the more complex stuff because actually the additional roles are taking some of the easier, quicker stuff away from us and leaving GPs with the really complex care stuff they can't manage because their training and stuff doesn't allow them to. So actually, you need more time to deal with that. You need more time to deal with the complex patients. So 15 minutes, absolutely. 20 minutes would be even better,
yeah, limiting surgeries to 3 hours twice a day as part of that limitation.
To clarify, that's clinical contact for 3 hours. It still recommends, obviously, 4 hours, 10 minutes from the indemnity perspective, including admin time and stuff. And remembering to factor in that you should be having admin time factored into your clinical contacts and stuff as well.
They talk about excess demand to be directed away from primary care. So obviously 15-minute appointments and 3-hour surgeries are going to mean that we won't be able to deal with all the demand, which is the intention of this, these changes that we've been talking about this evening, but to direct that away from primary care. So I guess that's not saying call us back tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. It's saying, I'm sorry, primary care is in crisis. We are full and you can go elsewhere to
walk-in centres, urgent care centres, CPCS. Although shout out to our community pharmacy team, their offer looks just as bad, if not, you could even argue worse than ours in terms of support for them to do all this additional work and stuff. So how they're going to manage a lot of that. And, you know, the CPCS works in certain areas and it doesn't work in others. Like my area, we we don't actually have access to any of that. So
yeah, and just to highlight, we're not necessarily these are not our suggestions, but we're just reflecting on the sorts of discussion that's taking place out there. I mean, to me, some of these initial points in the document from Cambridgeshire LMC sound a little bit like industrial action. To be honest, and we were talking last week about could GPs strike, can GPs strike, and all of that. These sound like some of the measures that we were discussing there, which I think is interesting and certainly not the effect that the government want with this with this document. They also talk another measure to protect the GPs and enable them to consult safely. They talk about duty doctors as the conductor of the acute demand, but to limit doctors to just doing split days and having a team approach, so just doing half a day on call to protect that doctor.
So I guess reading into this a little bit more detail, there are absolutely some practices where people will be duty doctor for the whole day, and obviously the risk of decision fatigue that comes with that. You know, I hear many times people saying they're having 100 plus contacts a day. Decision fatigue that comes into the play at that point is not safe for your patient. I've done that, let's be honest. You know, I've had that, and that's with me doing half day on calls. So my practice, we already have split days where you only do half a day on call. But you know, the level of decision fatigue that comes into play with that is significant, and it's a risk to patient safety. So you know, trying to put systems in place to mitigate that, absolutely. It talks about team approach, using care coordinators to divert patients to the most appropriate place for their care, whether that is GP, whether that's additional role, whether that's something else and stuff. And basically focusing on the minimization of burnout, patient, you know, and clinician safety, which then leads to patient safety as a result of it, because we do not have an ending supply of things. Talks about something about calling amending your NHS directory of service. Andy, do you know what that is?
I'm actually not sure. I suppose that's what you are. Is that what you're registered as delivering?
Effectively, yeah.
So you change what you say you deliver to reflect what you would actually be delivering under these circumstances.
Partly also to do with the wider system. So to say that you can't deal with additional capacity outside of your own practice needs. So for example, 111 directly booking into your patient list and that kind of stuff. So by amending that, that prevents 111 from being able to do that. I think, I don't know the exact specifics, because it does require some additional knowledge of how to do that. And you may even need to work with the ICBs. And there's really good instructions in the document of what to do and how to do that locally for Cambridge, and also potentially nationally in terms of who you need to speak to. But I think that is something you need to do on a daily basis as well, potentially. It's not something you just do once and then it's done forever kind of thing. Although please tell me if I'm wrong there. The really interesting one was the next one. So it talks about moving towards having a system of a waiting list for your non-urgent demand. You had some thoughts on this.
Yes, I think this is really interesting. And again, I'm not quite sure how patients would respond to it. But my interpretation of this is that when patients ring and you can't offer them an appointment on the day, or book them into a pre-bookable appointment in the next few days or up to 2 weeks, that you would, rather than say you could ring again in the morning, so we will add your name to the waiting list for a non-urgent GP appointment, and we will contact you when an appointment is available, and we may give you an appointment at a specific time and expect that you'll be able to make that, in a similar way to secondary care. You know, that's one of the ways that you can achieve the contract imposition outcome of not telling patients to call you back. It's if we won't call you back, we'll actually hold that and call you. There's all sorts of safety issues with managing patients whilst they're on waiting lists, and I'm not sure how patients would respond to being told they're going on a waiting list for a GP appointment, and whether that would go down very well. I don't know. For some patients, it might suit them. What were your thoughts, Candy?
I mean, it's the reality of what we have, isn't it? The waiting list is just called back, though. That's the different name of it. So I think it's an interesting concept. It does make the reference to doing this for non-urgent stuff. So this, I guess, is going to be your chronic disease reviews. This is your medication reviews. This is your, I want a letter for X, Y, and Z. You know, actually, do you need that? Is that an urgent medical thing? Probably not, to be honest. So it does talk about, you know, have you got the tech systems to do that, is a question.
It depends how far you're taking it, because I'm not sure it is necessarily just for paperwork. You know, it might be that it's other appointments about non-urgent you know, medical issues that might that might end up on that work. But I mean, managing a waiting list is something which we perhaps only do in some circumstances, say for your minor operations clinic and you know, application, you know, things like that. But I think that's interesting, and you know, it's something that they haven't said that you can't do that would enable you to manage the demand better within the existing resource envelope. So I think that's really interesting.
Yep. Next one was talking about re-triaging patients that have been booked into you by 111. I would highly recommend you do this anyway, to be honest. 111, assessments are not, shall I say, in my view, the most competent in terms of understanding the patients, and particularly actually a lot of times I've found it's patients have already contacted the practice anyway. So it's just about reassessing that kind of thing. If you are unsure about triaging, I think one of the things I will mention for EGP learners, just a sneak peek coming from May, hopefully, we'll have some resources to help you with triaging patients and stuff, you know, proper educational stuff to help you do that. Watch this space and things. But, you know, I think there are challenges that come with that. The last two points that the Cambridge LMC made are really interesting ones. So one is about communicating with your patients, the fact that you're making all these changes. And actually, one of the things I would recommend a lot of practices do is start communicating with, if you're not already doing so, communicating with your patients. Actually having the patients understanding the challenges you're in is so much more effective when you can do that. And often we get our heads stuck in the sand because we're so busy that we forget to bring the patients along with us. And actually taking them with you on this journey is just as important as going through the journey and the challenge that we're having. So if you are talking to your patients on a regular basis, whether that's through social media channels, you know, waiting rooms, whatever, if you want help with that, obviously EGP Learning is here to support you with that. And that we can also direct you to some people who probably do even better than us, to be honest. So absolutely check out groups like Redmore Health and stuff. A really good example, Albany Medical Practice, shout out to those guys. Their social media profile is flubbing amazing, far better than mine. They clearly know what they're doing and they don't even need me to help them do that and stuff. But definitely have a look at communicating better with your patients and some of the changes. And more importantly, inform them because they need to know the changes are happening. Yeah,
absolutely. And I would say make sure you're communicating with your staff as well, because given the sorts of things that are, you know, that will be floating around in the media about the state of primary care, it's important to bring them along and make sure that they know what they need to be doing to support the practice and support the patients, but also that they can feel secure in the jobs and employment and their role.
Absolutely.
And not take unnecessary risks themselves to support the system.
And the last thing that they talk about in a lot more detail, and you will need to look at the letter, and I can mention, so John has asked us, have we got the link to the Cambridge response? We do. We will put that in the show notes for the YouTube video and stuff, so do make sure you check it out on the YouTube one. So we will do that once we finish the stream and stuff. But it then talks about the GPAS rating system that they have. So that basically is their RAG rating, OPAL, as you want to call it, in some different areas and stuff. It details very clearly at what points from their perspective you would consider yourself green, amber, red, and black, which is obviously the one that many of our local NHS teams and trusts and stuff often declare themselves, forgetting the fact that general practice is probably in the black.
All the time.
All the time, yeah, and stuff. So do have a look at that document. I think it's got some really interesting perspectives in there. I think there are some definite other options to consider. And we talked about industrial action as an option.
Yeah, I mean, many have felt that might be a direction that this is potentially heading with the imposition of this contract without the involvement of the GPC. Yep. It may be a bit early to talk about that. I know the BMA is exploring all options in terms of the response. Do you think it will come to that? Can it come to that?
I think the profession is the closest it has ever been since I've been part of it to thinking about industrial action. Now, obviously, what on earth that looks like is the really hard part to understand. It'd be nice if somebody came up with an idea or discussion about that.
Well, we did a discussion last week.
Yeah, we did.
So people can link to that as well. So hopefully that's been interesting.
Yes. I think many people have joined us tonight. I mean, we're still on 70-odd people still watching us at 9:10 in the evening. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. If you have found this valuable, please, I know it's a bit YouTube-y and stuff, but do leave us a like, do share it and stuff, because that's the stuff that tells us that you like this content and that it's valuable to you. And actually, that's the stuff that drives us to want to keep doing it, knowing that we are of value to all the GPs out there and stuff. So if you're on Facebook, hit the like button. If you're on YouTube, definitely hit the like button, share it and stuff and things as well.
Have you got a final thought, Gandhi? What's your, having talked about this a few times and on a few occasions, what do you feel and think about this now?
Before we do that, should we just go back to the comments? Because we've had some cool
Yeah, sure. Actually. We've got some more good comments.
I think we've had a few people talking about various different stuff. And Nat's talking about access for acute problems, continuity for chronic problems, total triage allows this. So the benefit of triage systems, and, you know, we talk about some of the triage systems at play. I've done loads of stuff with some of the companies that help you support you do that and things. But I think, you know, there are ways that you can make triage part of the journey. And I know some practices still very hesitant about triage as a concept, but I think it can help structure your demand in a much more effective way. Mary talked about, what about the newly appointed BI managers? Now, I wonder if you talk about the digital transformation leads. So just to point out, they were approved in back in October. I think many areas are now looking at them. We're supporting some work to be done with that by Tara Humphreys and the, you know, the business business healthcare podcast and stuff, but I think they are still there. I've not heard the BI manager's a name. I think it's more the digital transformation leads, but they are part of the additional role still. We've just not talked about them because it's not a new thing as such.
I guess funding will continue, and I'm sure that there can be a way to write job descriptions that enable them to support access.
Kasim talks about, there's nothing about ceiling of contacts per day, and we need to define what safe focus is. Actually, there is. There's international stuff around this, European guidance and things, and actually the BMA have been quite clear. They have guidance. The issue
which
is
UK that, general practice routinely exceeds and perhaps has never complied with.
Well, the problem is the system doesn't allow us to, does it? The system doesn't support the fact that actually, you know, GP practice running at capacity elements in line with internationally agreed criteria and stuff. It's because obviously we are just the ongoing elements of stuff and things. Josh commenting about my stuff about the fact that GPs now seeing the complex stuff, so we need more time to deal with the complex stuff, and that's why nobody can see a GP anymore, apart from the fact that obviously most of leaving because it's so bad and things.
I think we are dealing with the complex stuff, but just not allowing ourselves more time in many instances, and that's contributing to the burnout issues.
Nuda talking about, it sounds like PCNs are creating a new walk-in center model for acute access. That's kind of what the Fuller Stock Take suggests in some ways.
Gosh, we had a big discussion about this in the car on the way on the way up here, with a slight difference of opinion about this, but I would support PCNs providing something that looks like, you know, the walk-in center type type access. I've got some issues with triage systems using centralized triage systems that then book out into practice resources, and whether there's moral hazard and whether the incentives are right to manage the behaviors of the people doing the triage. Complex discussion that we had and probably best continued another time.
We should have recorded it. It would have been a great podcast discussion, actually. But, you know, maybe we'll come to that another point. And actually, we talked about the difference between continuity and access on a variety of occasions. John talking about, if your patient pathways are working so that GP is only seeing complex patients, then yes, 15 minutes are needed, but this needs solving first. And then he talks about Ben Gallen from Ockham Healthcare talking about the future of PCNs. It'd be interesting to know what you think of him. Andy, what do you think of Ben?
He's good. We had a conference last week with him where people can probably access the recording by still signing.
Actually, let's do that. So just to answer John's point, so we actually do something called PCM Plus with both Ben Gowan from the General Practice Podcast and Tara Humphreys from the Business Healthcare Podcast. If you're interested in knowing more about that, and actually it is morphing into something bigger, I think, then do check out the links. I'll put those down below in the show notes so you can register for the conference recordings, and that's free.
So if people register for the conference and can watch the and can watch back the recordings, we did a panel discussion including Ben Gowland, Gandhi, Tara, and Mike Torres Health in Herefordshire, talking about the future of primary care networks post 2024, and that was a really interesting discussion. Ben does have some interesting ideas, and I agree with a lot of what Ben says.
Kasim's asking, how do we support GPs in training with focus on access? It's so different compared to when he qualified. Don't know when that is. Gone is all the continuity, and that's really, really sad. We just mentioned that and stuff. Jay's saying he's now going to have, if he's going to have a waiting list, I guess he's going to have to send an expedite letter to himself.
That's true. Yeah. Who will the patients go to expedite? Very good point.
So Marie talking about data managers and content IFF largely being binned. That's a good point, actually. Some networks have probably hired data analysts and that kind of stuff, and actually that's gone on. But interestingly, I think
they can do the access improvement data analysis, I guess.
Okay, it's a valid point. You may have had them to do particular things from focusing on INF criteria. okay, it's just a case of changing what they're doing. Maybe move towards, you know, the other criteria in terms of supporting QoF, maybe, as, you know, that's still part of the practice things and can be done from a network perspective. Or maybe, like you said, look at access, look at quality, cancer awareness, and that kind of stuff. There's loads of things they could
do. It illustrates the moving goalpost environment that we're in, though.
Kelly Barnes, they're changing the DOS, is declaring your OPAL status daily, declaring four turns of the DOS and telling the system you're full. Fair enough. And gutted you didn't record this. I just remembered it was happening. Actually, we did record this. Yep. So my comment about recording was about the discussion me and Andy had in the car. This has absolutely been recorded. You can go watch it by subscribing to the EGP Learning YouTube channel and going there and watching it. If you're happening to be watching us on Facebook, that's the best way to go watch the rest of the recordings, because Facebook's a bit weirder that way. If you happen to watch us on YouTube, absolutely, you feel free to go back and look at some of the recordings again if you want to go through that in more detail. We will timestamp this episode probably by Sunday, to be honest, because we're going to have some fun gaming tomorrow instead. And it is now almost 9:30. This is probably the longest episode we've ever done, Andy.
I think so. But many people, nearly 70 people, have stayed with us to the end. So thank you very much. And obviously, this is
You asked me my opinions, though.
Go on, let's wind up.
Okay, so I think overall, just in brief summary for everybody that is still with us, and thank you again for doing so. I think the initial reaction to the document is very much focused on those first opening sentences about access and stuff. And quite rightly, there is no additional funding being suggested by this document at this point in terms of supporting the access work. I think access should not be the focus of the government. That's my personal opinion, although I appreciate they have different motives for wanting that. I think that focus absolutely needs to move towards continuity. Could some of this help do that? Maybe. But I appreciate that's not what it's being designed to do. I absolutely support the reconciliation of the IAF and some of the changes to QoF. I think they could have done more, to be honest. There are some things that do concern me in the document in terms of some of the structure and stuff. And again, the ARS role stuff, a lot of it they should have just done about a year ago, to be honest, is my view. That's my personal opinion on the contract changes. Do they need to scrunch it up? I still think there's more that should be done. Whether it could be done is another question. I don't know the understandings of the finances in that echelons enough. And maybe we'll see more coming through. I would hope so. I would beg and plead NHS England to do more, because otherwise we are still, unfortunately, losing GPs on a daily basis. We're losing practices on a daily basis. And actually, this will not stop the bleed.
Mm.
That's my personal view. Andy?
Yeah, I think it generated some interesting headlines, which I think was probably the intention of some of the initial wording in the initial parts of the document. There are some positives in the rest of the document. I'm not sure that access is a great metric to track if you're looking at the quality of primary care.
You can track it.
Yeah, if actually what you're interested in is patient outcomes, patient health, then I'm not sure that access is the right metric to be looking at. And I think that there's an obsession with that access at the moment that I'm not sure is quite correct, although I appreciate it's important for people. But this is a continuation of that. Similarly, I think the underlying reason why people are having difficulty accessing their GPs is because of a decade plus of underinvestment in primary care, underinvestment in training GPs, in making GP roles attractive to people, people leaving the profession, and similarly difficulty with attracting supporting roles and nurse prescribers, pharmacists,
bureaucracy,
all of these things, increased bureaucracy. And I don't think that the fix is just to make demands to change or improve access within the existing funding envelope. I think the actual solution, if the government is really serious about sorting this out, is sorting out some of those underlying workforce and bureaucracy issues. So I'm not terribly impressed, but I wonder if the final outcome with the detail after the headlines have settled may be more manageable than people are worrying.
And we'll find out. So as we mentioned, the specifications are due to be still released. And obviously, we're still waiting for the general practice access report, whatever it's being called and stuff. Obviously, if that is out, you may be seeing it coming up about here. Alternately, if you want to check out our episode on Can GP Strike, because actually that's where potentially the profession is looking at now heading because of the anger and frustration at this particular document and the wording. Well, you can probably check that episode out right here. And as always, we're here to help tech enhance your primary care and learning. We will catch you in the next episode. See you later.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS, but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.